Now tonight, moving on to wrap up our fourth United We Strike Marathon, and Matt, you did an excellent job. We have, Rick is producing now. We've got Randy Mack from You Have Tread on Me. Randy, are you with me?
Hi here, Karen. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm doing all right. So Randy, and we also have David from andtheparty.org.
Hey, how's it going?
David, are you... Hey, you made what? It. I made it.
I managed to make it through the entire thing without even a micro nap. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, well, you and me both there. All right. And
I might not wake up till Thursday, but it'll be all right.
All right. And then we have Gary Hunt. Gary, I haven't met you yet officially. Welcome to the call.
Well, thank you. And thank you for inviting me.
All right. I'm going to turn this over now to Randy and David. This has been a great day. I hope that we get all the archives in order because we sure had some terrific information. Rick, thanks again. And thank you guys for all you do. Power to the people through peaceful unity. Gary, if you haven't heard of United We Strike yet, please check us out at unitedwestrike.com because together we can create miracles.
Well, I've been looking at the page today and it's pretty impressive.
That's great to hear. Remember, the 15th of the month, don't buy, don't comply, ask why. And right now I'm going to turn you over to Randy and David, and I want you to enjoy yourself, and thank you very much for being part of the show.
Well, thanks for having us on. And welcome to the last segment of the show, everyone. Sounds like it's been a whirlwind event today. A lot of information going on out there. This last segment, what we're going to do is a little bit something different. What we're going to talk about is an old solution to a modern problem that we're having today, a solution that was vital to the Founding Fathers and the creation of this country we call the USA. And with me tonight is David, one of my co-hosts that You Have Tread on Me on the Survival Sunday show, or actually the Survival Saturday show now. We've changed our broadcast days. And I brought Gary Hunt along with me. I have never met anybody with as much knowledge on the subject that we're going to be discussing tonight as Gary Hunt. Tonight we're going to be discussing committees of safety and what they were, the role they played during the Founding Fathers' time, pre-revolution, during the Revolution, and after the Revolution, as well as possible benefits of implementing them today and why they actually should be implemented today. So with that being said... Dave, Gary, how are you guys doing?
Oh, doing fine. Doing fine.
All right. Well, you know, the Committees of Safety is a rather complex subject, so I thought the best way to go about this would be more of a question and answer interview type process with Gary, kind of a basic Committee of Safety 101 type thing. So I brought a few questions along, Dave. You've got some questions in hand as well, so let's basically start with this, Gary. What were the Committees of Safety?
The Committees of Safety were the answer to a question that I was looking for when I got back from Waco. I was scratching my head and wondering how people got together. We saw the disunity during Waco, everybody going different directions, and so I started studying. And I ran across Committees of Safety, and the more I read about them, the more I was impressed. I realized very early on that without them, we would not have the United States of America. For example, the New York Committee of Safety, through the New York Provincial Congress, called for the first Continental Congress. They did it trying to get out of going into the non-importation agreement. They were trying to delay the process because everybody had been talking about the non-importation agreement, but there was no cohesive body. So New York called for it. Massachusetts agreed with the call, and then the other colonies agreed, and they met in the First Continental Congress and came up with the non-importation agreement. So it was a government that coexisted with the existing royal government, but was not a part of the royal government, and it carried its strength, its whole position throughout the entire Revolutionary War period, providing a government for the rebel side of the activity.
So basically, what you're talking about then is a civil body, a civil government.
It was a civil body. In fact, some of my more recent research ran across something interesting. In fact, I've written an article. I'll give my URL, www.outpost-of-freedom.com. If you go to that page, you'll see near the top is an article called The End of the Revolution, the Beginning of Independence. It wasn't the end of the revolution that you're thinking of. It's the end of John Adams' revolution, which was the period of time before Lexington and Concord where the thoughts of the people were changing. The revolution was turning over people's minds in John Adams' concept of it, and the war for independence was a consequence of the revolution. So the end of the revolution, in his mind, was Lexington and Concord. Now, we tend to look at April 19, 1775 as the beginning of the revolution. It is the beginning of the war. But for a year prior to that, committees of safety throughout western Massachusetts, not Boston. Boston was getting upset with these people because they were more offensive towards the British than the people in Boston were. There were two acts as a result of the Boston Tea Party, the Boston Port Act, which embargoed Boston and put restrictions on them. They had to pay back the loss of tea and everything. But at the same time, or a few days later, and coming over on the same ship was what was called the Massachusetts Government Act. The Massachusetts Government Act revoked the Massachusetts Charter. It required that all city governments submit their agenda to the Crown, the Royal Governor, for approval prior to the city government meetings. It mandated that all both the judges and the justice, the members of the court, the legislative body was called a court, had to be approved by the Crown and had to abide by the new rules, not the original charter. So the people in western Massachusetts really didn't like this. And for almost a year prior to Lexington and Concord, the committees of safety would send their militia to various towns where they were going to seat and swear in the judges. They would go armed, and they would tell the judges, do not accept that commission, or if they had accepted the commission, they would say, you will resign. And the judges either resigned or fled to Boston and stayed there for the remainder of the all through the war. So these were civil bodies now that broke away from the royal government. Long before Lexington and Concord, a year before Lexington and Concord, and in at least one instance in Worcester County, they actually declared independence from the royal government, the first declaration of independence that I'm aware of, and they established their own court system for criminal matters only, and they excluded civil matters. So they became a civil body before the war began in many places. Albany, New York, I've got the minutes of from early 1775, February 1775, 2 months before Lexington and Concord, where they're meeting and discussing and dealing with problems on a civil level. Now, they were still under the purview of the royal government, but they dissolved that relationship with the royal government as things progressed. And there were committees of safety in many communities, not in Boston, not in New York City, but in the smaller communities on the frontier. There were no police departments then. The idea of policemen was foreign. Actually, what we call policemen today would be the standing army, but all of the perimeter settlements or the settlements out in the frontiers or the areas where they might be subject to Indian attack or other problems all had committees of safety. They hired a watchman to watch at night and sit out the call for fire or Indians. They administered the civil government, totally independent of the royal government. But on April 12th, 1775, exactly 1 week before Lexington Concord, John Hancock was the president of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress, and he sent out a flyer. And if you go to www.committee.org, you'll see right on the front page a copy of that flyer, asking all of the communities in Massachusetts to create committees of safety if they did not have them. So now we've got the movement towards establishing committees of safety throughout Massachusetts, with the intention of acting outside the capacity of the royal government. So actually the move for the first government independent of the royal government occurred, the call for that occurred 1 week before Lexington and Concord, and then we know that the Committee of Safety called the militia out in Lexington that morning, and the militia stood firmly for a short while, and subsequently militia were sent from Woburn, from Concord, from all over that region to meet at Concord and deal with the British, which they did all the way back. Now, that was the end of the revolution, according to Adams, and I think appropriately so, because the mindset had been made that this government is despicable, we're going to kick it out. So this government was created, unlike any other revolution I've ever read about. A government was created and in place before the battle began. And that government carried us all the way through to the Articles of Confederation.
You know, that's interesting, because when you look back at the history, when you look back at the history of the civil body, especially pertaining to the militia, it goes back to Magna Carta, and the militia always had to be subordinate to a civil authority, correct?
That's right. If we go back to Magna Carta, people were allowed to have weapons. Anybody was allowed to have weapons, but they were obedient to the it's some weird title, but he was a civil authority in a shire, and their obedience was to him. So there was always, in fact, you know, obedience to civil authority. There was a fellow, what was his name? George Washington. He was a member of the Congress.
Yes, he was.
And he was in Philadelphia with everybody else when they got word of what happened at Lexington and Concord. And a short while later, he was nominated to be chosen to be general of the army. So he resigned his seat as a delegate to the Continental Congress. And throughout the war, as we all know, through all the events, trying events, for example, he would not burn New York. Now, could be he did under the table, but he'd asked permission to burn New York, and the Congress said no. He was absolutely obedient to the Congress. He always got permission for anything he did, unless it was an emergency situation. He had asked permission to bombard. They had cannon, and had finally gotten enough powder around Boston. And he asked permission to bomb Boston, and the Continental Congress said no. So he was very obedient. He was the epitome of obedience to civil authority during the entire period of the Revolutionary War, because he would never go against Congress, even though many of his officers had suggested that he do so.
Well, you know, that's interesting as well, because as we saw, the Committees of Safety formed the Continental Congress. So the Continental Congress was a national gathering of the Committees of Safety. Now, Washington, who was a member of these Committees of Safety, resigned from the Committees of Safety when he took control of the Continental Army, which was made up of the militia. And then he subordinated that militia to those Committees of Safety.
Well, there were actually two armies. Now, he was put in charge of the army, which gave him direct command over the militia under the immediate circumstances around Boston. They started forming the Continental Army, which was hired directly by the Congress, where the militias were all responsible and funded and supplied by their local Committee of Safety. As Committees of Safety got stronger and got state level and got their own provincial congresses going, independent of royal government, then the state would act in the capacity of the supplier of the pay, the uniforms, the supplies they needed. And so eventually, within about less than a year, the Continental Congress would actually put levies against the states for militia members to support Washington's troops. Washington then was having trouble with militia because they were short term. They would be 3 months, 6 months, or 1 year terms. And even the Continental Army, and he was constantly retraining people. So there was a change in structure as time went along to develop a more efficient and better trained army. But yes, in every case, the militias were assigned to Washington by the civil authority, which took them out of the civil authority, put them under Washington, who was under the civil authority of the Congress. So there was always a relationship with civil authority, even though there were the pass-offs of militia all the way through the war.
Now, you had mentioned that during the Revolutionary, or during the pre-revolutionary period, the committees of safety were really responsible for a lot of the things that happened then. During the Revolution, now, what role did the committees of safety, as you mentioned, the committees of safety played the role of the interim government, basically, the civil authority, the local body of the local people who kept the government running and who kept supplies coming in, kept life going, correct?
Well, let's go back to Boston. When Boston was embargoed, there was nothing coming in. The British would not allow anything to come in through the port for the benefit of the people in Boston. No food, no blankets, no supplies. Everything that came in was for the British. Now, I'm sure there was a little black market going, but there wasn't enough to supply the people that chose to remain in Boston. The Albany Committee, for example, somewhere around May, voted and sent blankets and food, pigs and chickens and cows down to Boston. Now, there was a constant traffic over Boston Neck. Now, at the time, Boston had a neck that was something like 28 feet wide at the narrowest point and easily controlled, but the British were allowing people to come in from western Massachusetts with supplies as long as, well, no arms were allowed in, but they were allowing food to come in. They didn't want the idea of people starving, I guess, even though they wouldn't feed them. So the committees of safety all around that region, the New England area, were sending food, blankets, clothing, and supplies, and medical supplies, everything, into Boston. And the committees were the ones that were preparing it. In fact, there are a lot of records of, I think even Maryland, I've got a record of them having an inventory of stuff they were shipping down to Boston during that period. And later on, they were doing the same thing to New York, because when the British freed the rebels out of the New York area, there was a food problem in New York, especially in the entire Long Island area. So yes, they played a role constantly throughout the Revolution. In the South, a lot of the fighting was being conducted solely by militia, because the Continental forces had not gone south in any great degree. So a lot of the skirmishes or battles that you hear about in the South, Kings Mountain and everything, were done by militia. There was only one Continental officer with the Americans at Kings Mountain, and the rest of the troops were militia.
So now, the committees of safety, as we historically, then they were extremely vital to the formation of this country. So let's kind of fast forward this to today, with the situation that we find ourselves in today. Social unrest, a lot of problems in our country, a government that's run amok. If we look back at the Declaration of Independence, we find that a lot of the grievances that they complained about, we can go down the checklist and we can still check those off today, and many more on top of that.
Right.
And one of those solutions...
You know, if you go to committee.org, down towards the bottom of the first page, there's a little matrix, and there's some boxes there that'll take you to different pages. And there's an article that addresses some of the things that a committee might do today. I mean, they could be political advocacy group, not for a political party because they have to be independent, but they could be an advocacy group for a candidate or an issue. There's no reason they couldn't. Everybody's concerned about survival now. We've been having survival conventions around the country since the 90s or before. And if you think about it, if we get in a survival mode, if there's a disaster and we're in a survival mode, most people right now are concerned about their family. Well, that's great. So you've got you and your wife and three children, and you're prepared to take off to the mountains and set your tent up and live on the land there. But if the man has to go somewhere to do something, or if you've got a car and it needs fixing and the man's not mechanically inclined, a committee of safety is a small community in itself. And in that type of environment, you would probably have a mechanic. If the father had to go somewhere, there would be other fathers around to protect his family. It would be a collective. It was a collective self-defense effort in its original concept against fire and Indians. It was a collective self-help group under the throughout the Revolution, especially in the South. And so, if you've got a committee of safety, you've got a community working together, not just a family. So you've got a very secure situation. You've got a defensive situation if necessary. And I don't know if we're going to talk about it tonight, but we've been talking on Randy's radio program about something, about a plan for the restoration of constitutional government in the United States. And in that capacity, they even work in a defensive capacity that nobody can be arrested unlawfully, and you'd have to get involved in that whole subject to understand what an unlawful arrest is. But the community is working together to protect itself. As there are more communities within a state, for example, or say within a county, say you've got three or four different committees in a county, then they send a couple delegates up to the county level, and so if you've got four units, you've got eight people at the county committee. If you feel you need more, they can send more delegates up. But you've built the second tier when you get to the county level, and then when there are enough counties to work together, then you move up to the next tier, which is the state tier, and each county sends a couple or more delegates up to the state level, and you've got a state committee of safety. Now, during the course of the Revolution, there's a book called Provincial Committees, and it was written by Agnes Hunt, no relationship to me, but she deals only with the Provincial Committees of Safety, which was that third tier. And it didn't exist for the most part until long after Lexington and Concord. For the most part, the committees were working as independent units when they sent people to Philadelphia the first three times. But you're building from the bottom up, and you could call it grassroots. Well, Randy and I were talking about it the other day, and actually we should look at it in the reverse perspective. You're working from the top down. You're working from the people in the community down to the county, who should be subordinate to the people in the community, down to the state, which should be subordinate to the counties in the state, and then down to the Continental Congress, which should be subordinate to the will of the states or the colonies. And I think that this will make clear that back in 1776, on July 4th, I think we all recognize that date, Thomas Jefferson penned something that we think is one of the most phenomenal documents in our heritage. It's called the Declaration of Independence. There were at least 90 declarations of independence that preceded Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. So that is top down, from the people down to the Continental Congress, that all these little communities, cities, counties were declaring independence. I mentioned the one in Worcester, Massachusetts, declaring independence. And it took a couple of years for the people in Philadelphia to catch up with the people. Now, that's the way government operated back then. The people were on top, the government was on the bottom. The people in Philadelphia were working for everybody else in the country. They weren't their rulers, they weren't their bosses, they didn't dictate. They finally caught up with these people. And so the concept of committees of safety, if you think about it, where the delegates aren't dangled in front of you by a political party with a platform in mind, but instead any platform they have is built by being sent up or down from the people, and then that's followed by the national body, the Continental Congress. That's the nature of government that existed at the time. That's what existed under the Articles of Confederation. However, it gave too much independence to the various states and didn't give enough strength to the the national government, and that led to a constitution where the national government was given certain specific powers that they had to have to be able to exist and function. But the concept back then, even with under the Constitution, was the people decide what they want, they send this information down to the president. In fact, there was a guy, Red Beckman, I don't know if Red's still around or not, but he came down to Winter Springs, Florida once to speak to a group that I'd set up, him coming down to speak to a group of patriots back about 91. And Red is talked about the government as looking at like a pyramid. The people, this is the way we're taught in school, the people on the bottom, then the city government, then the county government, then the state government, then the Congress, and then up at the top is the president. That's what we're taught nowadays. What Red said is you've got to take that triangle and turn it over. The people are at the top, and the president is at the bottom. Now, I never quite understood that concept that Red explained to me back then until a few years later when I began looking into the committees of safety and realized that's how it works. If we had 90, think how small the country was back then. If there were 90 declarations of independence out of 13 colonies,
each committee,
there's almost eight declarations of independence per colony before the federal government caught up and said, hey, let's declare independence.
So basically what you had was the local committees of safety deciding on their own that they were going to declare their independence. It went up to the state level where the state started saying, we're doing this, and then the feds caught back up.
They caught up with the people, right, which is the way it should be. Now, let's take a vote. Who wants Obamacare?
Not I.
Silence. Well, yeah, that silence should go either to Washington as well.
Absolutely. Because you are absolutely right, because that was the working model where the people actually had the power, and that's what this country was founded on. And over the course of our history, we've gotten away from that. That would be kind of an interesting thing to touch on now is, you know, what happened, you know, as we progressed with the committees of safety and the civil authority firmly in the hands of the people, how did we get to where we're at right now?
I'm sorry, Dave, what was that?
And how did we get here now?
What was the question again?
How did we get to where we're at now, where the triangle has been turned over on us, where we used to have the committees of safety with the civil authority firmly in the hands of the people, you know, where, you know, the people were the top tier of it, all the way down to the very bottom, you know, which would have been the federal government. And the world we live in right now, they've turned this upside down on us, where they're trying to tell us that the, you know, federal government is the top. Everything's supposed to be subordinate over there, because when we used to have committees of safety, that was not the case. And we had committees of safety after the war for a while. And then there came a time where these things started to disappear, and it's been purged from our history.
Well, I think to understand that, to achieve that again, we need to understand some fundamental things. Now, if you've read enough history outside of the textbooks at school, that you would know that, say, before the Declaration of Independence, some of the colonies actually had to send back to their state assemblies and say, well, they're going to vote on independence, but we were told not to vote on it. Can we vote for it? I've got a lot of instances in the records that I found where delegates were sent to the Continental Congress with specific instructions. We want you to support this. If they go this way, you walk out. Now, that was the original form of representation. So let's look at that word representation. If you hire a lawyer, he represents you. Now, he's got to do what you want. He might try and talk you out of it, but he's got to do what you want. Back then, people did not campaign for office. They were there. Now, their friends might say, you need to vote for Thomas Jefferson. He's a good man. But we didn't have political campaigns like we do now. But we call them representatives still. So these promises that they make, well, think back to the instructions that were given to the delegates when they went there. And they would not go, they were men of integrity. They would not go against their direction without getting permission to do so. And that occurred as in the Constitutional Convention as well. So if they represent us, we don't give them instructions anymore. And maybe we need to get away back to doing that. And there are a lot of ways. There was a method in old English history called the hundreds, And I think there's a biblical reference to the hundreds as well, where you tear people up in groups of in tens. But if we look at representation, and I guess my favorite phrase is, read my lips, no new taxes. So if I vote for somebody that elicits my vote by making that promise, and then within a month he decides he wants new taxes, and if you don't know that I'm talking about George Sr., I am. When he says, I want new taxes, does he represent me anymore? Because he went to represent me, and on the promise that he made about read my lips, no new taxes, I voted for him. Did he breach the contract? Did he reject that representation that he took of mine when he went to Washington?
Absolutely.
Well, unfortunately, the Constitution doesn't have any provision for us to get rid of those guys until 2, 4, or 6 years later. Maybe, you know, that's probably, in my mind, that's probably the biggest failure in the Constitution, is there is no provision for punishment of people in public office except by their own bodies. You've got impeachment, you've got the Senate and the House of Representatives can punish the members within their own bodies, and that's it. There's nothing that we can do until wait out the 2 years, and they know how bad our memories are. We don't remember by the next election what they did at the last election. In fact, this Tea Party election, I've got a list of what people said was going to get done, and I'm waiting until May to run the list back to the people and get a checklist, see how much of it got done. But if you understand how Congress works now, too, is these guys go up there and they've made the rules within the legislative bodies with committees and all this, and the fact that they can put amendments on big bills. And the example I use, and this is what we're facing, and we've got to find a way around this. But say a guy from Iowa gets up there, he's a Tea Party candidate, and he's got a dam in Iowa. It's going to take $1.5 million to repair the dam. It's getting dangerous and posing a threat to the downstream. So he gets up there and he writes a bill. What do I do with this? Put it in this committee. So he throws it in the committee. A couple months later, he says, hey, you still got my bill in your committee. When are you going to put it out? And he says, well, as soon as we need your vote on something else. Okay, here's one, Obamacare. We're going to put yours as an amendment to Obamacare. Well, I don't want to vote for Obamacare. Well, if you want to vote for your amendment, you're going to have to vote for Obamacare. That's how it works in Washington. And so even if they have good intentions when they go up there, the system grabs them, snarls them up in this web, and destroys their ability to represent people. They have written the rules to deny us the representation that we have, or should have. How do we get it back? There's groups called PCOs, and I don't remember exactly what it's political coordinating committee or organization or something, but it's people on a local level that pick delegates. And I know a few people in rural areas that are working in this capacity, and they believe in the committees of safety as well. But what they don't realize is the population areas out in their rural communities, if they go in and get a bunch of constitutionalists on this organization and they pick who the delegates are, that's not going to affect the high population areas. But if they tried that in San Francisco or Los Angeles or New York, Chicago, both parties would go in there with all their money to make sure that they got their people in. So who gets on the ballot is decided at these organizations. And we're not going to get people on the ballot that represent us. They're going to have ridden on the coattails of the party and proven their obedience to the party to get elected to a position. The only way to change it is to make some substantial changes in the election laws, denying parties the ability to encourage candidates, for example, or give them funds or do anything to affect the outcome of an election. But then the parties aren't going to give that up, so there's only one way to change it. That's by force. I hate to put it that way, but that's exactly what they did in Western Massachusetts. They went out there with their rifles and said, you will resign. Now, I can't say the committees were behind these activities, tarring and feathering. Probably some committee and militia members were participating in it, but not openly. Tearing down customs houses, warehouses, and Governor Hutchinson's mansion and a few other mansions. Tarring and feathering people. Some of those people that were tarred and feathered, in fact, quite a few of them died. It was very dangerous. You know, if they got the tar hot enough, the skin would come off with the tar. There was no way to get it off, exposing them to infection and ultimately death. A lot of people who were tarred and feathered went back to England. The crown would give them a pension because they did this for the crown. But then there was the destruction of what would probably be the equivalent of a couple million dollars worth of goods in Boston Harbor. So sometimes stepping beyond the law becomes necessary to impress upon the government that they have an obligation to us. Those people that carry signs, you know, they're carrying them on a little stick. If you hit the cop with the stick would break into 30 pieces. If they at least carried their signs on a pitchfork or a rifle barrel, maybe the people on the other end of those signs would start thinking these people are serious. But I don't know any way we can get that back to the way it's supposed to be unless we go to our state and federal level and restructure things. But the people in power are not going to restructure them, which is why I came up with this concept of a plan for restoration of constitutional government in the United States. And it follows exactly what the Founding Fathers did from the beginning to the end, almost exactly what they did.
You can find that, actually you can find that at www.outpost-of-freedom.com. We've compiled the archives there, and also on my Blog Talk site, blogtalkradio.com/outpost-of-freedom, or uftreadonme.com.
If you go to outpost-of-freedom.com, near the top, you'll see Outpost of Freedom on Internet Radio. If you click that link on the left side, you'll see all 10 programs of the plan. That starts with the first three are about committees of safety. The fourth one is relation of militia and courts to the Committee of Safety. And then 5 through 10, the last six, are about the plan.
Now, you talked about the relationship between the committees, the militia, and the courts. And you talked about, you know, we've talked a lot about the roles that committees would play during a time of natural disaster or man-made disaster, time of crisis. Katrina, I mean, take a look at Katrina. Would the situation have been as bad as it was in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina if there had been a well-established committee, if there had been several well-established committees of safety and militia there?
Well, I can't find historically where the militia was sent on a good deed trip. Only defense. I mean, militia means soldier. However, committees of safety, as I pointed out, would gather blankets and food and send them to Boston, and I'm sure the militia are the ones that took the wagons down to Boston to deliver these things. Of course, when they got to Boston Neck, they had to park their guns somewhere before they could go into town. But there's no doubt that it would be beneficial if a committee of safety got their name recognized for participating, but you know, we got a little problem in this.
I'm also talking about the kicking in of doors, the knocking down old ladies and snatching their weapons from them, the police that were openly rampaging and pillaging upon the people, committing murder and rape on them. Talking about a lot of those.
That is definitely the purview of the Committee of Safety. If New Orleans had committees of safety, I don't think it would have happened. Now, understand, however, that in this country, this free country we live in, we're freer than all the other countries in the world unless there's a crime scene. And when they put that yellow tape up, you can't cross it. That's why they told people to get out of New Orleans. Now, people have a right to protect their property. The government doesn't have a right to kick them off their property because they might be endangered. Their responsibility is to protect their property. The committees of safety's responsibility is to protect the people in that community. And so had they existed in New Orleans, I'd like to think that they would have had the militia surrounding this neighborhood and saying, no, cops, you get out of here. And perhaps we wouldn't have had that murder that I think 5 New Orleans police officers are going on trial this week, or went on trial this week over murdering a guy. So yes, they serve that. That's the defensive purpose of the committees of safety.
Yeah, that's what I was referencing. I wasn't talking about goodwill deeds, which is always a good plus. I mean, you know, we could always use some good PR out there. You know, so hey, get involved if you can and bring good PR, because the only way to combat the bad PR, you know, that the militia get out there, and you know, we the people in general, is by active participation in your community. So, you know, hey, if you can get some good PR or something, get some good PR for your militia, your committee of safety out there.
Well, that PR should be for the committee of that PR should be for the committee of safety, not the militia.
Well, there you go. Get the committees of safety. But remember, though,
yeah,
you know, the militia and the committees of safety were vital for the protection of we the people for a very long time at one point in our history. And I think that's
absolutely.
Role. Now, something else that we've mentioned before about the power of the grand jury. Let's talk about grand juries for a moment and how they're convened. Because there seems to be a lot of confusion out there about grand juries and how they're convened and who convenes a grand jury and what role they have.
Well, if you go to outpostoffreedom.com/library, you'll find a very interesting essay written in 1904 that went back through the history of grand jury all the way back through English times. But, you know, when it gets to the period during the United States, it was written in this country. When he gets to the period of the United States, he talks about it, and they're commissioned, and the sheriff is actually, in most cases, each state had a different version of the grand jury, but the sheriff draws lots out of a jury wheel to select the grand jurors, but he's operating under the authority of the civil body. Now, the civil body appoints the courts, the judges. So the civil body creates the grand jury, and it creates the petit juries. The selection of the jurors is on the sheriff and it's been transferred since then, but is on the sheriff to go to the jury wheel and pick people for both grand and petit juries to determine probable cause and to try people in court. Where, if you think of the grand jury, you don't defend yourself. If you're the accused in the grand jury, the complaint side presents the case, presents the story. You are not represented in a grand jury, and as is pointed out, why the need for the grand jury and the value of it is if it doesn't, there's not enough to go to court because the claim against you is not strong enough, then this grand jury of now it's 12 to 23 people. You don't do 24, but in most states, 12 had to agree to an indictment. So when one side's presented, and if 12 can't agree to the indictment, it doesn't go to trial. Now, if it does go to trial, now the other side, the accused, gets to offer his witnesses and everything. That's where he has the right to meet his accuser and everything. But the structure of that is all civil authority. Now, there's another word that we've lost track of. What it means. When we say public, like public lands, we think, well, that belongs to the government. No, public means the people. It doesn't mean the government. Public lands does not belong to the government. They're strictly the caretaker, whether it be a public park, no matter what it is. That is the purview of the people. And so when we look at how we've turned the control of the jury and the courts and everything over to the government, we've destroyed the concepts that this country was built upon regarding courts, juries, trial, and everything else.
Now, another aspect of the grand jury, though, that was always there and is still, is still the right of the people, is the power of the grand juries to make presentments against the government or against businesses, whatever.
Yes,
we've lost those powers of presentment because we don't have any civil authority because we're not being granted the civil authority.
Right, and we'll use the federal grand jury for an example. If federal grand jury, if somehow, now, the U.S. attorney is usually in charge of a federal grand jury, but the old ability of any member of the grand jury to bring a matter before the grand jury has not been denied. They're afraid to take that one away. But the way they work it on the federal level is just say the jury comes in with, or one of the members of the grand jury comes in with a bill of complaint against an officer in the state government. And they hear this and they say, yeah, there's a crime here. This has to go to trial. On the federal level, any a true bill has to be signed by the U.S. attorney or it's void. So he has a negative. He has a veto power over the actions of the grand jury. Now, since 1904, a number of states have adopted the same principle of denying a grand jury true bill by the officer that's been assigned to control that board. Now, the original grand juries were not controlled. The matters were brought by a prosecutor, and this is where they've usurped power beyond their authority. The prosecutor could bring any case before them. He worked for the government, generally the civil authority. It might be a sheriff in some places. It might be an attorney or something, but they could bring cases in there. Some grand juries were open to complaints from the outside to be brought in, and others, they had to come in through the members of the grand jury, but all you had to do is know who was on the grand jury. And back then, people knew who was on the grand jury, so you could go to the guy and say, turn this in. Now we've got this thing where we want to keep it a secret, who's on the jury and who's on the grand jury. Well, it can't be a public trial, the jury, who everybody is. So slowly they've negated the ability that we used to have to bring charges against the officers in government that were violating their oath, doing criminal acts. Now it's only CBS and NBC that, if they yell loud enough, somebody in government might have his neck on the block. So yes, all that's gone away, and to get that back is a very complex process. In the You Have Tread on Me petition, which you can find on either youhavetreadonme.com or on outpostoffreedom.com, it even proposes a federal grand jury with no influence by the government itself, that people be sent from each of the states to participate in this grand jury, and if they bring an indictment, it will be tried in the state that that person claims to be his home. Unless and until we get back to where we can punish the evildoers in government, we're stuck with what we got.
Now,
and so, you know, back to Dave's question, to get it back in the hands of the people, we've got to get it back in the hands of the people.
Now, as far as the civil authority goes, now we're talking about the militia having, you know, being the civil authority. So again, would the militia have, or I'm sorry, not the militia, the committees of safety, would the committees of safety then have the authority to call for grand juries to be convened against politicians, judges, corrupt cops, things like this?
When I read about Worcester, Massachusetts, and them setting up the jury to handle criminal matters, they did not talk about a grand jury. Maybe the fact that they were so small back then, when a grand jury has to be 12 to 23 people, that you really can't take a community. And I don't know what the population. Now, remember, white males over 21 back then. Actually, you had to be a freeholder or a freeman back then. So you have a limited pool to choose from, but they don't mention a grand jury. But yes, a committee of safety, acting as a civil authority, would obviously have the authority to call for that grand jury. I have yet to find that being put in place. It could be under the exigencies of the Revolutionary War that they chose not to go with grand juries and go strictly with complaints. But by the time we get to the Constitution, we've got the guarantee of a grand jury in Article 4, Section 5, I think, of the Constitution. So the grand jury is ordained by the Constitution now. That's reassured. Now, I'm sure habeas corpus was dispensed with in a lot of cases during the Revolutionary War as well. But so would it be necessary during the course of change? Probably not. Exigency again that if somebody's charged with being inimical to the rebel government, you try him. What the heck? That's you'd have to understand the plan to understand what I just said.
So basically then, what you're looking at then is the committees of safety were the civil body of the people, made up of the people, whereas the militia was that defensive body, the civil defensive body, made up of the people. The committees of safety the militia were subordinate to the committees of safety. They all ensured that the courts ran properly during times of chaos or times of hardship or trouble or whatever. I tend to see a pattern going on here that basically our founding fathers created an infrastructure that they saw that would be needed during a time of trouble where they would have to have a smooth transition of civil authority taking a role in the running of the daily affairs of the government, well, during like the revolution.
Each state was allowed to set up its own constitution and structure of government. The federal one was considered unique. Unfortunately, a lot of the states that came in the Union later on modeled theirs very much after the federal one. But they didn't plan that because that was understood. The concepts of justice in this country, and that's what we're talking about, were understood back then. People knew what habeas corpus is. Most people have no idea what habeas corpus is now. They think it has to do with death row convicts, because that's all you'll see in the paper is, some guy on death row is pleading habeas corpus. It doesn't mean that. It means jurisdiction. Is there proper jurisdiction? But we've lost sight of that. They've watered everything down. The idea that, well, by definition, we're self-governed, right?
Right.
But wait, we're not. We're governed by those people in Washington, those people in the state capitol. What happened to that? The concept of self-government was embodied in the Constitution. The concepts of justice were carried over, and the phraseology was assured us both in the Constitution and in the Bill of Rights. Now, that phraseology stands. When it says grand jury, it means a grand jury. It doesn't mean a function of the government. It means a grand jury. But we've allowed that word grand jury to be taken by the government, just like the public lands belong to the government. The grand jury now belongs to the government as well. And they control both the public lands and the grand jury. So even though it wasn't written, it was there, it was inherent, it belonged there, it still belongs there, but we've had it taken away from us. That's called usurpation, by the way. But that's what the Founding Fathers complained a bit about. But understand, when the Founding Fathers, they're coming up with a concept that was unique in the world. They took mixes. They took what the Six Nations in this country had done in some aspects. They looked at Sparta and Athens. They looked at Rome. They looked at Holland. They looked at the German republics. They looked at Italy. They looked at a lot of forms of republican governments that had existed in the past, and none were like what they had in their mind. So they had a blank sheet of paper, in a sense, when they got started. They had some ideas, but they had a blank sheet of paper. And if you think about it, they did a pretty good job putting together the Constitution, but they weren't able to look into the future and see how contemptible, power-seeking people might corrupt that system. And it was those contemptible, power-seeking people that have managed to usurp authority that was not granted by the Constitution, because the Constitution didn't anticipate unethical people in government. So
I've got a question that was
the intent was there.
I was going to say I got a question that was Skyped over to me a minute ago. I wanted to ask you about it as well. You know, we had mentioned before how Washington had resigned from the committees of safety Continental Congress when he took command of the army. Now, why? The question is why can't you be in both the Committee of Safety and the militia? Why do they have to be separate?
Can you be your own boss?
Well, I mean, can you explain that, though? Obviously, that needs some explanation out there.
Okay. Well, can you be your own boss? I mean, that's the starting point for it. The concept goes back to 1215, the Magna Carta. That the concept, look at revolutions in other countries. When it's a military coup, the military is in power. That was never a concept in English history. There were militaries used to defend or to overthrow government. But there were always civil governments in our English heritage that were responsible for the administrations of government. We didn't do what Rome did, where we took the military leaders and put them in power. That was an objectionable situation.
Another example would have been during France, during their revolution. I mean, look at the bloodbath that became afterwards. You know, throughout history...
Where, in France?
Yeah, in France.
Yeah, well, France didn't have... They had the committees of public safety, but they weren't... They were self-proclaimed. They're like they were very much like, what's that one organization called, committeeofsafety.org, that's on the internet. They were very much like them, where it's a platform, and you've got the people in charge telling you what to do, just like the Republicans and Democrats. That's what Committee of Public Safety was in France. You had I don't remember their names now, but you had these leaders that set up a party called a Committee of Public Safety, and then told people to do what we tell you to do. The people didn't tell the Committee of Public Safety what to do. It worked the other way around. So it was backwards.
You know, let's talk about that. But, you know, you bring up a good point there. The Committees of Safety historically were always a bottom-up organization where the people of the local townships told the county what to do. The county told the state told the national or federal, national government, or the national committees what to do. This other committee, the committeeofsafety.org organization, that's a very top-down org structure. Now, how does that jive with, I mean, that's what we have today currently. We have a top-down structure where the federal government tells the state what to do, the state tells the county tells the town, and then the town tells us. And we must obey.
Or the Republican party tells the Republicans, and the Democratic Party tells the Democrats. Yeah. That's assuming leadership by people you don't know to pick people that they know that you think you know to represent you. It doesn't make sense. It is totally contrary to the concept that I find in American history through that period of time in the late 1700s.
Can you find any documentation where the Continental Congress was in charge and they were telling everybody else what to do?
No, I don't. Now, what I do find, I mentioned a book by Agnes Hunt. It was called The Provincial Committees of Safety. In fact, the entire book, I think I've got a couple states that I've still got to get up there, but the entire book is republished on committee.org. If you go down to that matrix at the bottom, you'll see Provincial Committees of Safety by Agnes Hunt. If you go there, it'll be that book. Now, Provincial Committees of Safety came later, much later. She ignores in the book. The book is very good in dealing with the provincial level committees of safety and their relationship with the Continental Congress, because they were pushing up information. But what it fails to do, and what she failed to do, she did not go into the committees of safety that created that provincial committee of safety and set their delegates up to that committee of safety. So missing that bottom link, or that top link, however we want to look at it, kind of confuses the whole concept. But the instructions were coming up through the delegates because they had integrity and they would not violate their promises to the people. When they were sent to the state level, they would not violate their promise to the local committee. They would not vote. They would abstain rather than vote against what they were instructed to do when they went up or what they promised to do. So if we take that bottom tier out, Agnes Hunt's book is a good explanation of that specific, the provincial committees of safety. And they did send the information up as explained in the book, but they didn't just come out of nowhere. And that's, the book doesn't explain where they came from.
Chicken before the egg.
The whole idea of any organization coming up with a platform and saying, this is what we want, and then people subscribing to that platform is ludicrous. The idea should come from us if we're self-governed. We shouldn't. I'm going to use my favorite analogy. I used to use the analogy of voting for the lesser of two evils, and people don't really grasp that. They'll say, well, it's better to have the lesser of two evils than the worser of two evils. Well, yeah, that's probably true if that's the only choice you have. But let's look at it another way. The Republicans dangle a turd in front of you. The Democrats dangle a turd in front of you. Doesn't matter which one you vote for. Doesn't matter who wins. You get a turd. That's all there is to it. It's not a lesser of evils. It's a piece of shit. Pardon my language on the radio, but that is the way it works in this country. And it will work that way until we learn again how to push things upward the way they're supposed to be, the will of the people. Now, we have some good instances in our history. Probably the most recent, and oh, to you it's just history book, to me it's just history book, but if you study it a little bit, you'll find it rather interesting, especially in context of the way, the kind of laws we get nowadays. But it seems back in the 1920s that you could not, 1919, something like that, I'm not sure the date, but it took a constitutional amendment to outlaw alcohol. Now, I'm not sure how it got passed. I'm not sure how the states thought that was a good thing or not. But what happened after they prohibited alcohol, transportation, production, consumption, everything, after they, by a constitutional amendment, they got rid of that, people in the jury room would not convict people for moonshining. They might in Chicago. I don't know what happened in Chicago, but I know all over the country people would not convict people because they had the right to judge both the law and the facts. And so they sent a message up to Congress, and finally Congress, like Jefferson with the Declaration of Independence, says, oh, they don't want prohibition of alcohol. Let's repeal. So they did. Now we can go back to the Dred Scott decision. You have to return the slave to his owner. Well, and anybody who violates that law is criminal. But people on the Underground Railroad were being tried by a jury of their peers, and the jury would say, not a valid law. Dismissed, acquitted. Finally, the government began catching up with it. There are a lot of times in our history in the past where we see demonstrations through the judicial process of forcing back up the stream what the will of the people is. Now, every time that happens, the government gets a little bit tighter and tries to put sticks in the spokes of us trying to push it back up. They'll tell you in court now, no, you have no right to judge the law. Well, that's bullshit. We've got our heritage. We've got the right to a trial by jury in the Constitution, and that means the right to a trial by jury as they existed on July 4th, 1789, when the Constitution was ratified. That's the grand jury that's in the Constitution. They can't change the meaning of the word. They can't play verbicide with a jury trial and make it mean something that it didn't mean back then. Law has to be intent.
Comes through verbicide, though, like you mentioned. I mean, a lot of our enslavement really does come from that. I mean, and it's really imposed enslavement upon ourselves because we don't understand what the hell they're saying, so we agree to it, and by our very agreement and acceptance or taking of benefit from them, we commit to a contract or whatever it is. But a lot of it comes because we don't even know what language we speak anymore. We don't read enough. We don't study enough. And they're constantly changing the damn language on us.
Well, they are. It's called verbicide. And I mentioned public, mentioned representation. There are a lot of others. License is an interesting one. License, by legal definition, is the right to do what would otherwise be illegal. That presumes that the government has that you can't get married without the government. Now, I don't know. I thought God ordained marriage is not the government, but maybe I'm wrong. Marriage, there's another one. Marriage is a function of government now. It's not the concept that's existed for a few thousand years where a man and a woman joined together with the purpose of procreation and cohabitation. Now, it's a right, a civil right, granted by government, and, well,
it's otherwise illegal.
I don't know what to say there. I mean, here's another one. Gay. What does gay mean? Happy. Happy. Jovial. When I was young, queer was a homosexual. A homosexual was a homosexual. A gay person was happy and jovial. They didn't have necessarily a sexual orientation. We got a serious problem when we allow words to change the way we think. Political correctness is the art of changing the what a word means, so that we're forced into accepting a condition that's contrary to our thought. There's a problem with that.
Oh, there's a huge problem with that. You're absolutely right, and it's rampant amongst everything. And you were mentioning licenses, a driver's license. We have to have a license to travel. It's otherwise illegal to get in our car and travel. You know, that's ridiculous on its face as well. And, you know, as far as the interpretation of these words, do we really need the Supreme Court to tell us, you know, what the Constitution says? Cannot we read that and decide for ourselves? It's written in pretty clear, concise language.
Well, if you consider the debates that transpired all over the country back then, it seems that the little guy out in the farm in western Massachusetts understood more about the Constitution than the guys in Washington today.
And that's still the case.
Well, that's why I say Washington today. Back then, I think the politicians understood it. But then I think that they began early on taking advantage. Well, there was a matter of interpretation. And, you know, I've had some discussions with people over the Alien and Seditions Act. And the right to freedom of speech. It's kind of curious because what Adams wanted to do was stop the opposition, what in England they'd call the loyal opposition or something like that, from bad-mouthing Adams. He didn't like what they were calling him. He was very proud and didn't like the names they called him, so he wanted to make it illegal.
So
well, some of the Alien and Sedition Acts were overturned by the courts. The remainder expired at the end of his term. But it was a test because we've got to see where things are. Now, it was a test, and it was done in open, and the results were clear, and everybody understood that. And we haven't had anything like Alien and Sedition Acts until just a few years ago when we got the Patriot Act. And more recently when we've got our own government calling us terrorists. So the test was done in public. The effort to define or more meticulously define an aspect of what was in the Constitution was conducted in public. It played out, and the results were known. And again, with Dred Scott and with Prohibition, we've got the same thing. But nowadays, we're denied the ability to test those things. And I'll give you a good example. There's a requirement in the Constitution that only Congress has the power to declare war. Well, that was kind of interesting, and it was tested by a guy named Thomas Jefferson when the Barbary pirates were seizing American ships and shipping, imprisoning and selling into slavery some of the seamen, selling the cargoes and seizing the ships. So Jefferson did not go to Congress. He took the Navy and the Marines, and he said, you go down there to what's now Libya, and you put ashore, you know, you determine your tactics, and they put ashore, I think, about 40 or 50 miles away, and then came back in from the inland and attacked Tripoli. They killed a bunch of people, left a lot of bodies laying around, got all the seamen that they could find, they got some of the cargo back, and they got some of the ships back, and they left. Well, that wasn't, a declaration of war wasn't necessary, and a statute was enacted after that that gave the president the authority to, under certain exigencies, to conduct an operation like that. However, if it went beyond, and I think the time period was 90 days, then he had to go to Congress and seek a declaration of war. Now, if you go look at the comparable statute today, it says the president can do that for up to 6 months, but every 6 months he's got to go back to Congress and say, can I keep going? So the idea, the whole concept of a declaration of war, which was well defined through our history all the way until the end of World War II, has been wasted. Korea, Vietnam, and everything that we're in right now is a violation of the Constitution. Now, Judge Napolitano, it's a shame he has that last... No, it's a shame the bitch has the same last name as him. That's what it is. But the other day he was on Fox News, and he was talking about something that I harp on all the time. If we want the Constitution, we've got to take it completely. We can't say, well, that doesn't suit today. If we want to change it, we've got to amend it. But the provision for a declaration of war is very clear in it. Only Congress has that power. A declaration of war has certain elements. Who is the enemy and what's our objective in this? Now, if anybody can tell me who the enemy is in Afghanistan and what our objective is in Afghanistan, who our enemy is in Iraq and what our objective is in Iraq, I'd like to hear it. I've been trying to find that for a long time. Now, I get unpopular for saying this because I'm a conservative, and I don't believe in the right of the king to make any war he wants. I believe in the Constitution.
I'm right with you there, Gary. I'd like to know myself, you know, what's up with that. That's the reason there's been no lawful declaration of war, because they don't have a clear enemy. They do not have a clear objective. You know, that's why we have this Charlie Foxtrot overseas. You know, they have completely run amok and done this completely illegally. We've not had any declarations of war since World War II.
Well, that, yeah, that's exactly it. And what happens when there's a war is you get that warm, fuzzy sympathy. Everybody's waving flags, and they're not really looking around. And history tells us that when any country's at war, whether, you know, the opposition to the American Revolution in England was put down once the war started. Pitt and some of these other guys were put down. I can't remember all the guys that were on our side in Parliament, but they were pretty much shoved aside once the war started. They were almost treasonous in supporting those damn rebels over there. So when you have a war going, you get to create division that wouldn't otherwise be created. When you create that division and you've got a good side and a bad side, or at least it appears that way, you can get away with almost anything you want.
You know, Bernays said,
as a tactic,
Bernays said that you can create more change in 5 years, more social change within your country within 5 years of war than you could with 75 years of propaganda. And look at all the social change that has been created within our country since World War II.
Since 2001.
And we have been especially at war the entire time. And when we're not at war with the country, we're at war on ideologies. We're at war with drugs. Can you point to the enemy there? How do you defeat a drug problem? I mean, do you have a clear and defined enemy that you can go after and obliterate? And, you know, but we have these constant social wars that we're in. We have wars
the
on
CIA.
For education. We're in a constant state of war.
They cost lives. They take away rights.
And they internalize militaries.
It was interesting that Napolitano mentioned the war on drugs and the war on poverty as well. Because they are unconstitutional to even call them war. And he pointed out, as I have many times, that the Supreme Court in a case called Ex parte Curin, which had to do with some five Germans in World War II that snuck on, they were German soldiers, they snuck in on civilian clothes. But when you read the case, the most interesting thing about it, now, habeas corpus is jurisdiction, and jurisdiction has to be established. We don't see that in court anymore, but what the court did, the Supreme Court in Ex parte Curin first said that Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. Roosevelt went to Congress and asked for a declaration of war. Congress granted the declaration of war. Subsequently, Roosevelt returned after Germany declared war on us, I think it was April 15th, 1940, 2, that Germany declared war on us. He went back and sought a declaration of war against Germany, and Congress granted that. So they've set the foundation now. War exists. Now, you heard years back, unlawful enemy combatant.
Yes.
That was where that phrase came from. But it was established because they, as they pointed out, a declaration of war had been granted or imposed by Congress. That was a prerequisite to calling somebody an enemy. There can be no treason without an enemy, because treason is aiding and abetting the enemy and giving him comfort. Without a war, there is no enemy. So the government is making enemies all over. But nobody, theoretically, constitutionally, nobody in this country could be charged with treason today, no matter what they did. Everybody wants to charge people with treason, but you can't do it because there is no enemy. That's getting back to the Constitution. That's the way it should be.
Yeah,
I don't
absolutely
know how we get back there peacefully, but
we got to try everything we can and have, you know, strong resolve and follow it through to whatever end that it takes, you know, and hopefully we can do it peacefully, but we have to be willing to take it all the way. You know, the enemy belligerent act, they're doing all sorts of things on us where, you know, they can just abduct people, do whatever they want, no trial, no jury. This war on terror, you know, is more an excuse to attack the public than it is anything else. You know, this whole terror thing's, you know, been mostly manufactured and incited by our actions, you know, other places. And they've been abusing that on us, you know, the TSA and all this other crap. And now that they want to be able to have the president be able to just, you know, say, oh, you know, that this person's a threat. Now we get to just execute them, judge, jury, and executioner at the top. And this is completely, you know, in fast defiance of what the founding fathers, you know, set up, you know, with this government where the people were supposed to be at the top. You know, now we're all enemies. You know, that they have these, you know, codes out there where, you know, any crime basically is now terrorism.
Well, you mentioned something interesting. I wrote an article a while back called Let's Talk About the Constitution. The Constitution, we the people, we have had authority. We had certain rights, inherent rights, and we gave some of those to government. Now, unless they were denied back to us in the Constitution, we retained them as well as government, correct?
Absolutely correct.
Okay, so the government
rights.
So the government now has assumed that we have given them the right to kidnap, torture, and assassinate. Now, the Constitution doesn't deny me the right to kidnap, torture, or assassinate. So based on the government's actions, I think it's fully lawful for me to assume that the government has expanded my rights to include kidnap, torture, and assassination.
Yep, by the logic they're using, you could definitely follow that and come to that conclusion.
Because until we get back to the Constitution as intended, and as long as we've got the de facto, not the de jure, but the de facto application of the Constitution, I think that lawfully we have that right. It can be inferred by their actions that we have that right, which is one of the fundamental principles in the plan. And Dave, I appreciate your thinking there's a peaceful solution. I'm well beyond that point.
I'm getting there too. You know, we try everything that we can, and we have to have the resolve to, you know, follow this through. And if it's going to get ugly, we're going to have to stick to it, and we're going to have to follow this through to the end. We can't just stand up for a little while, you know, kick a few teeth in, and then back down. You know, if we want to have our country back, we're going to have to do this by any means necessary, and we're going to have to keep coming. We're going to have to show them that we have the strength and the resolve, that we're done with all this garbage that they're doing to us. We're done with the usurpations and the abuses, and we're going to have to stand firm and never back down until we get this country restored to what we had in the beginning, where the people are at the top.
Now, Dave, you followed the plan, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
The Tuesday program?
Yes,
okay, now,
I have.
The plan, you know, I've been asking for people for 20 years, you tell me what the peaceful solution is. And if you do that, you tell me what your benchmarks are and what your timeline is to achieve these things. What are the benchmarks and what is the timeline so that we're nowhere they were making some progress? And nobody's been willing to come up with the benchmarks and timelines in 20 years. And finally, a while back, I got thinking about this. And, you know, I would like to see a peaceful solution. I think, well, the women will appreciate this from observation, the men from practice. But it's like pissing into the wind. You're going to get your pants wet. That's all there is to it. The plan is developed around minimizing the amount of violence to achieve the goal we're pursuing. Absolutely minimizing. I can't think of a way that could be more peaceful than what's proposed in the plan, though it is not peaceful. It is just, like I say, designed to minimize the amount of death and destruction.
Until the government and the corrupt people that are in it realize that we're serious, they're just going to keep right on abusing us. And we haven't seen any resolve in any of the actions that have been coming forth, you know, in history, pretty much, you know, since all of this has happened. You know, we have these big protests, we got marches on Washington, and then everybody goes home and nothing changes. Okay, we protested. What did that accomplish?
Well, we still haven't tried ours yet. Haven't all stayed home collectively, so nobody goes. Like, what if they gave a war and nobody showed up?
I stay home all the time.
That's part of the plan.
I've been, so do I, Gary. And you and I are on the same page on that. You know, and neither one of us has been in this system for a very long time. I don't play ball with it. Gary hasn't played ball with it. And if we can get enough people to do it quickly enough, you know, maybe that's going to do something. We can give that a chance. But we are going to have to be willing to take this to the next step when this fails, if it does. And we really have to get people to have the resolve to, rather than just, you know, staying home one day, we need to just withdraw completely. We just shut this stuff completely down and go, no, we're done. We're not playing ball with this anymore. You know, we have got to escalate this, you know, a little bit at a time. You know, they're really not taking us seriously. You know, they're thinking we're going to back down.
That's why we need to be prepared, too. And if we stayed home for 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, imagine what would happen if we stayed home for 5 days in a row and told them, we're tired of you screwing us. We're staying home. We're not playing your game. Screw yourselves for a while. We're taking care of our families. We're taking care of ourselves. We're taking care of our communities.
Can I just make an observation?
There's a prime example of that going on currently that just happened, in fact. And it's sad that that's going on there and not here. France shut down their country. The people of France shut down their country again. They do it quite regularly, in fact. We can't even seem to protest meaningfully anymore.
Yeah, the French are much more regular than we are.
They shut down their country.
Well, they're not fluoridated, though.
Much more socialized, too.
Well, they're not fluoridated because they don't have the brainwashing and the chemical lobotomies.
Well, I don't have fluoride. My water comes directly out of the ground.
Good for you.
I've drunk my entire life, and I'll tell you what, I am by no means lobotomized by any means. I joined my first militia when I was 17, and that was a long, long time ago.
Well, I think I've not Howard been, Beale. But I have a lot of people that tell me I have been, so I'm not really sure.
To quote Howard Beale, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. You know, I'm really done with this.
That's that part that Dave was talking about, though, that resolve to say, enough, pull out. You're tired of the banking system? Yeah. Pull out.
Yeah,
let's go
you
back
know,
to committees of I safety.
I agree with that. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Let's go back
to the committees of safety, too. Now, if you listen to the first three programs of the Committee of Safety, we talk about the UF Dread and Me petition. If we had, say, 300 committees of safety around the country and they all push this You Have Tread on Me petition, and if you read the petition, it doesn't cover one thing or another. It covers a multitude of things. If you read it, and if Congress did what we demanded of them, it is modeled after the Olive Branch petition. The Olive Branch petition was the last shot at a peaceful resolution. It was sent to the king in 1775. He rejected it. And all the naysayers then were out of the picture. They had nothing more to say. And it's a demand on Congress. It is a petition for redress of grievances. It's not a petition to get the local school built bigger or anything like that. It's very comprehensive. So if the committees of safety got organized in this country, say we had 300 of them, and they went around their communities and got all these signatures on the committees of safety, and each petition, you have threatened me petition, and each petition gets one signature. It's not 300 signatures on a piece of paper. It's one signature on each piece of paper, so you have a stack 300 high when you put it on somebody's desk, and you send it to a representative and two senators, so that's three copies that go out from each person that signs it. That would show the government what we're looking for. That's our objectives. That's our declaration of war, you might say. Do this or else, because if not, you don't represent us anymore. Now, that so the structure of the plan, even though the plan doesn't specifically address it, is predicated on that olive branch petition going to government saying this is the last chance for a peaceful solution. Don't just do get rid of Obamacare, or don't just get rid of the Patriot Act, or don't just get rid of airport scanners. Get rid of all the shit. Get rid of administrative agencies. Get rid of corporate's right to freedom of speech and to buy politicians. Punish politicians for taking money from these people. Cut them back to salary only. The Constitution says they will only get salary. They don't get benefits. They don't get retirement programs. They don't even get free health care, according to the Constitution. But they get a package. If they've served one day in office, they get a package the rest of their life that's worth millions of dollars. Cut all this stuff out, and if you don't, then that's less. You don't represent us anymore. You are not our government. Now, if they don't abide by that, then we start pushing. We start pushing a little harder.
Something I'd like to add there, though, you know, unlike other petitions out there, this one is very clear. It not only defines what the problem is that we're addressing, but the solution to fix the problem. Unlike every other petition out there that says we want this, it doesn't tell them how to go about doing it. You have to be very specific. We lay forth the problem and the solution to resolve that problem. As well to solve every other problem that we have in this country, including the loss of power that we the people have over our politicians.
Go ahead, Karen.
Well, I was just figuring I usually don't vote, but I'm about ready to vote for Gary for president.
Yeah, you can vote if we could this committee of safety, you can vote him in the national committee.
If we could get him to run, I would be all for that. You know, Gary's a good man.
You know, if you're in this committee of safety, vote him
up to the
national.
If you read the plan, though, if you read the plan, I would rather serve on the Constitutional Compliance Convention than be president. It anticipates that a lot of people in Congress aren't going to understand the Constitution, so it creates a kind of a Continental Congress that's an advisory committee to this the Congress that says you can enact this because it's constitutional. It writes reports on every bill. Well, first, everything goes back to July 4th, 1860, before the Civil War, because that's when the multitude of bad laws came. And so we go back to there, and then we look at what's good and what's bad. If it's bad, we throw it away. If it's good, we send it back to Congress and say, you can enact this. But they go on for up to 10 years until Congress is trained in obedience to the Constitution. They're a totally separate party body. They're not legislative by any nature, but they're, let's say, the wisdom that understands the Constitution has done enough study to understand it. So we train the people that are going to act in the capacity of our representatives. And I think, you know, the guys that served in the Continental Congress were far more important to the founding of this country than even George Washington was as president, as far as they were the thoughts that made things happen. And so I appreciate
who were the guys in the Congress again? Who were they made up of?
Those are the guys that came up from the committees of safety, a level at a time, bottom up. They weren't the turds dangled by the party. No, they weren't. I've just posted
the committee of safety's need again.
I've just posted the URL on Skype for the petition. If anybody is interested in reading it, and I think if you do, you might be surprised that it is inclusive. It can't deal with things that can't be dealt with, like who did 9/11, Obamacare. Well, Obamacare would be dealt with because administrative agencies would end up being abolished. But it can't deal with something, or whether Obama's a citizen or not, it can't deal with that. But it can deal, if you read it, it can deal with things that are totally, every one of them is within the purview of the Constitution. And if they were enacted, this country would be in better shape than it's been in over 150 years.
But it would give the people a chance to file a complaint, and if enough people file a complaint, a federal grand jury would be convened to investigate these people and find out if these claims are valid.
And then that would have the power. The interesting thing about the grand jury, though, too, remember that we have no authority under the Constitution to go after politicians or people like that, public officers. However, the Constitution in Article 3 makes a provision that the Congress can establish inferior courts. And so what we're doing is telling Congress to establish this grand jury as an inferior court and the subordinate courts to it in each state as necessary. So we're staying within the Constitution in creating a way to punish the people that are supposed to represent us that don't represent us or do criminal activities.
Wait, I thought we already had inferior courts. Isn't that part of the problem?
Well, yes, it is. But this inferior court could even go after those inferior court judges. You know, it's interesting that out here in California, where I unfortunately am, I thought I'd be close to the beginning of the battle, so I know it's a long story, but the judge ruled that Proposition 8 was unconstitutional. Now, California's got the longest constitution in the world because unless it's specified otherwise, every proposition submitted on the ballot becomes a part of the Constitution. That means when Proposition 8 was voted on by the people, it was ratified by the people and became a part of the Constitution of California. Now, how a judge can declare that something's unconstitutional that's part of the Constitution is beyond me. How can that happen? So in looking into that, I started looking around and I ran across a phrase in Black's Law Dictionary. We were talking about verbicide. Judicial activism, that's got kind of a nice sound, doesn't it?
It sounds
nice. Well, how about judge laws? That's what they're legally called. When a judge makes a law, if we go back to school busing where the judges said, you got to do this and you got to do that, this back in the 70s. You got to drive these people 300 miles to go to school, and then you got to drive those people 300 miles to come to this school. Those are judge-made laws. Those aren't lawful. They're a violation of the Constitution. Now, if we call it judicial activism, we can slide it by because it's got a sweet sound to it. But if we call it what it is, if we call queers queers and we call judge-made laws, maybe people will wake up and realize that judicial activism is another turd being dangled in front of us. That's verbicide again. Come on, somebody else got to have something to say now.
We've been talking about this for so long, though, man. I mean, we've done 10 shows alone on the plan. We did 3 hours on committees of safety. We even brought about a specific state and situations they're having with illegal immigrants and how committees of safety could effectively be used to help resolve that situation there.
Arizona?
You know, so
we even talked about
for you and me, this has become so second nature about talking about it. I don't even know what to say anymore about it. You know, we've discussed.
But you know, you got to fill the gaps when I run out of things to say. I just got to fill them.
Guys, we've been in overtime for about a half an hour now, and you've really sparked our interest in this committees of safety. Any comments before we wrap up for tonight?
Well, yeah, I've got a comment on Black's Law Dictionary. It was something I picked up on a forum not so long ago. I'll post it in the room so you've got a reference point. But it generally points that Black's Law isn't really taken seriously by solicitors or the law community. You know, I don't know. I don't practice law, but it was a forum I came across, and I thought it might be quite interesting. So
we should send that to Obama.
It is. It is rather interesting. You know, Blacks is keeps up with the times. For example, if you went back to Blacks III, income was gain, and now income is they do point out that income is all that comes in based on the Internal Revenue Service. But a lot of their sites, though, are founded on Supreme Court decisions. Judge made law doesn't have a site on it. But for example, United States does, is Hooven and Allison versus EVAT, and it defined the United States in a Supreme Court decision that there are three United States. One is the one that faces the rest of the world as a sovereign nation. Two is the area defined in Article 1, Section 8, where exclusive jurisdiction of the federal government is. And three is the state member states of the Union. So when you see the term United States, if you think about which one it means, they all have a legal legal definition. And if you know which one it is, there is a court site. Now, they might ignore that, but they ignore a lot of things. They ignore habeas corpus. They ignore the right to a trial by jury of your peers. They ignore a lot of things. And so I can understand that they're displeased, because a lot of these definitions in Black's Law Dictionary come directly from Supreme Court decisions or local lesser courts, appellate court decisions.
But I also find it quite interesting, because the a lot of the free man movement, the definition of the strawman, the legal fiction, the person, as John Harris would probably put it, also comes from Black's Law Dictionary as well. So it does. It's an interesting thread. I don't think it's finished, but it's quite interesting. I'm undecided on the movement in that area at the moment.
Well, there can be a lot of misconstruction of what's in Black's Law Dictionary. And this whole straw man argument, I know a lot of people in prison that thought that the straw man argument was valid, frankly. They seem to think that this legal fiction, as they call it, was created by legal fiction. But what they don't understand is what happened in this country in 1937 and 1946. 1946, the Administrative Agencies Act, the Congressional Record used this phrase, "We are creating a fourth branch of government." Now, my Constitution only has three branches, but they admitted creating a fourth branch of government called Administrative Agencies, and they gave them rulemaking authority. Now, before that, in 1937, in a Supreme Court decision, Ashwander versus TVA, the Supreme Court, Brandeis, pointed out that there are seven or eight items that the court uses in determining how they're going to rule on any matter before the Supreme Court. The first one is, if at all possible, if there's any other way of ruling, we will not rule on the constitutionality of a matter before this court. And then they say one that I think is fascinating. Anybody who seeks a benefit from an administrative agency is bound by the rules of that agency. Now, that means then if you go in and get a driver's license, you're applying. Now, applying is asking them to give you something. So you're seeking a benefit from the driver's license people. They give you that benefit. Now you're bound by their rules, Constitution notwithstanding. So people try and create these, what they call the legal fiction from, you know, a lot of it, like they want to start with the corporate United States in 1871, which just created the District of Columbia as a municipal corporation, and bring that all the way forward when they don't have to go back nearly that far to find out how we got screwed. And
if you go to things like the driving license, it can't necessarily be a completely bad thing for people to undertake a test to make sure that they're competent to drive on the roads. I mean, after all, if you didn't have a limit on this, I mean, you could have 8-year-olds out there in a car, and that can't be a healthy thing, surely.
Well, there's a way to do that, though, and we did it with pilots in this country for many years. It's called certification. So you go down and you take a test, and you're certified as a driver. License said to do whatever is otherwise illegal. Requiring a certification to prove you're competent is fine. Licenses bring in money every year. That certificate is good unless I do something that proves that I'm not competent to continue practicing that.
I mean, here in the UK, I mean, what we've got to do is we go through a certain... We have a few driving lessons, and then we take a test, we pass our test, and there's, you know, once you've got your driving license, there's not a yearly thing on this. That's it. You've got your driving license, unless you do something daft and it's taken away. I don't know if that's different in America, possibly. Do you pay yearly for your licenses over there or something?
Well, we did, except so many people have driver's licenses, and the people that work for the government are so incompetent and slow in their activities that most states have gone to 2, 3, even 10 years for a license now.
But again, though, let's remember what the definition of a license is. It's permission.
It is illegal to travel unless you get permission from the government.
It's a permit giving you permission to engage in an action which is otherwise illegal.
Illegal.
A marriage license.
If you look at the history of marriage licenses, rather interesting, because they were issued early on in this country, not the English style, because back in colonial times, like in New Jersey, I know that you had to get permission from the governor to get married. But after that, after the Revolution, marriage licenses were required for those who, it refers to miscegenation. Now, you know what miscegenation is, don't you? That's a white person marrying a black person.
No, I didn't know that.
The original inception of marriage licenses in this country came from avoiding mixing races without the permission of the government. Now, let's look back in the 20s and 30s when syphilis was fairly rampant in this country. They required a blood test to get a license. And I think that's, for as near as I can tell, that's when they started applying it to everybody, not just cases of miscegenation. So what they did is they said, for your own safety, we want you to get a blood test so that before you marry somebody, you know if they've got syphilis. Well, that's great. It's a good idea. So we'll accept that. But let's jump forward, 50 years, and now we've got AIDS. Most states have recognized that if you go down and get a marriage license, do the blood test, and one of the parties has AIDS, due to the privacy of that party, the state can't tell the other party to the marriage that they have AIDS. So they'll tell you if she's got syphilis, but they won't tell you she's got AIDS. Something wrong with this picture. And let's go a little bit further. When people get married, this is legal definition again, when people get married by a license from the government, and this goes back to the miscegenation issue, that there are three parties to that marriage, and in a dispute over that marriage, the principal party is the government, the court. So when you didn't know that you married the government when you got married, did you? But you did.
Yeah, I got married in June, and I was aware of it, and I wasn't happy about it, but the wife insisted.
Well, my first wife's parents had their marriage certificate hanging on the wall in their bedroom, and I used to look at that, and this is 40 years ago. Used to look at that marriage certificate. I thought you got a marriage license, and it wasn't until... about 20 years later, 15 years later, that I started getting interested in this stuff, and I looked up license and right to do what would be otherwise illegal. Why can the government make it illegal for me to marry? But they got married without a license. The church issued a certificate. So let's go back to driving. Pilots in this country for years had what they call a ticket, but actually it's a certificate. The only thing they have to do is have so many hours a year in a certain type of aircraft. It was a non-expiring license unless they did something that proved that they were incompetent. Driving, if it were the same way, you prove. Well, go a little further. I've got a concealed weapon permit in my wallet. It expired in 1991. In 1990, Florida went to a statewide concealed weapons permit. Now, I wanted to prove that I was competent to carry a weapon, so I went down and got the license with the intention of never renewing it, because to me, that becomes my certificate that I'm competent to carry a concealed weapon. I've carried a concealed weapon all over the country when I was traveling talking about Waco. I never ran into a situation where I had to show it to a cop, but if I did, I was going to say, here's my certificate that I'm competent to carry a concealed weapon, and he'll say, well, that's a license, it expired in 91. Well, I didn't, in my ability or my competence to handle the weapon, didn't expire in 1991 either. So I'm not expired, and my competence is not expired. I'm just showing this to you so that you know that I am competent to have a concealed weapon, and if you want any more authority, look at the Second Amendment.
Nice.
I don't want to run into the situation, but yeah, that's the way I see it.
I mean, if you're competent enough to get the license in the first place, then yeah, I agree as well. The same, but you know what I'm saying with things like driving is I wouldn't want. Yeah, I'm dubious about 18-year-olds or 17-year-olds in this country that get in a car and drive, let alone probably up till 25 because they're all mostly boy racers that drive us insane or moped drivers that have no regard for oncoming traffic or any of those other issues. But I think it's a good check. We didn't have, back when common law was introduced, common law in the UK has been built up over many years anyway, but you know, we didn't have cars back then, so I think a license to a certain degree is a good idea, as many ideas of government start. What's it they say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Yep.
Probably rings
well,
true.
Let's look how a certificate might work in that situation. With a license, if that kid goes and has an accident driving high speed in town and causes damage, he goes to court, and if he pays the fine to the court, he gets to go out and drive again, right?
Well, not really. I mean, it depends on the situation. You can have, in this country, I think it's slightly different in America, I'm not 100%, perhaps you'll correct me, but in this country, if you drive without insurance, you're breaking the law. You have to have insurance to drive.
Yeah, we got that socialist thing going on here as well.
It frustrates me because the insurance company, I think insurance companies are behind so much fraud, it's ridiculous. It's easy. I mean, if you want to make a shitload of money, there's two things you can do. You can set up your own bank, or you can set up your insurance company, because insurance company is dead money, it's money for nothing, and they've obviously cottoned on to this. And insurance company is driving things like the health and safety industry in this country, as well as other things. And if you're 17 years old and you've just passed your test, insurance is absolutely phenomenal. Absolutely, it's you're talking you're talking best part of £1,000 a year to get insured on a car, which in dollars is probably $1,800, $1,800 a year, or something like that.
$1,600. Yeah.
Let's look at what you just said. Now, you said insurance is lucrative. It's lucrative if you can get the government to pass a law making the insurance mandatory. That's what makes it lucrative. If it's voluntary, it's not as lucrative.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's look at the certificate. Yeah. What would happen in this situation with the certificate? Kid gets in an accident, causes some damage to your property. So he goes to court. Well, his certificate is suspended until he restitutes you for all the damages caused. And if they determine that he's not competent to drive, they remove his certificate completely, tell him you can't come back for a year, and then you can come back and apply again. Now, the state makes no money on this because the fees aren't there, but the idea of justice is to protect us. Justice, more than anything else, is making whole again the injured party, whether it be contract or crime. It's not feeding the state.
There must be a victim in order for there to be a crime.
So if you go to with certificates, you've got the
If you're driving a car, you drive down the road and you hit someone there, you've got a victim. It's pretty easy. It's a pretty open shut case. If you've got somebody with no insurance, then if that person needs medical treatment for the rest of his life, then at the end of the day, he's going to have to fork out for that himself. And there's a moral argument which I kind of understand to a certain degree, but I think it's pretty unfair the way it works, and it should probably be regulated a hell of a lot better. But you know, where do you draw the line? Where do you say, okay, well, we don't have any regulation. We go back to common law. We go back to horses and carts. Because our evolution, you know, we've evolved a hell of a lot, you know, since the Magna Carta. There's all sorts of laws that I think are useful. On one hand I say, you know, watch out for what's coming. On the other hand I go, well, watch out for what you could lose at the same time.
Well, do you have no fault insurance over there?
Fault insurance, no, I mean, fault. We have house insurance. We have building.
No, an automobile.
Insurance.
Automobile.
Automobile. We have what we have a three-party system. We have third party, which is if you hit anybody in your car, you're covered on insurances, damages to them. We have third party fire and theft, which is if you hit anybody, they're insured. If your car's stolen or burnt out, then it's insured. And you have fully comp, which is, you know, whatever you do, you're insured. So if you're driving to someone and set your car on fire at the same time, then you're insured. If somebody hits you and they're not insured, you're insured. But fully comp is the traditional.
Well, that sounds like what we used to have here, but now most states have gone to what they call no-fault insurance. So if you have an accident that's caused by somebody else, your rates go up. And generally, your insurance covers your car.
That happens here as well. We have a thing called an excess over here, which will be if I drive down the road and I hit someone's car and I cause £300 worth of damage, depending on my insurance policy cover, I will have to pay £100 for the first step, you know, the first £100 towards that claim. £200, and it, you know, you're talking, that's a year's policy anyway. On these claims, they're raking it. I don't like insurance companies. Insurance companies, I think, are a big, very, very, very big downfall on our community. Especially these no win, no fit, no win, no fee solicitors.
Well, when you have a system that's enforced upon you, you really have no choice. Then at that point, they can do whatever they want. They can collude with each other to not do certain things or to promote certain things or that everybody will do certain things.
But the frustration is there's a lot of good in what happens as well, you know?
There is, but can't you be creative and think about how with a certificate you could accomplish the same thing? We got along without insurance for a long time. And if somebody did restitute the damage, you owned him.
Gary,
my mother used to say when we were kids, if something happens, they're going to take our house. That means that you had to make up any damages that you made. If you want mandatory insurance, that's fine. Or if you want, comprehensive insurance to protect you if he doesn't have money.
That's where insurance is evolved from.
What do you do if you can't afford the insurance?
Well, then you're breaking the law. You can't drive without insurance in this country. End of.
No. If you can't afford the insurance, then you know, if you can't afford it, the other person that you hit should have it. I mean, you know, if you can afford it, you get it. If you can't afford it, you don't.
I mean, you're receiving a basic right to travel at that point as well, due to financial indebtedness.
What if you run over a I mean, I'll play devil's advocate every time. I'm terrible for it. What if you run over a family with not a lot of money? They're struggling, they might have 5 kids, you hit one of their kids, you've not got any insurance, they can't afford any insurance of their own, and their child is permanently disabled and they've got to pay for that for the rest of their lives.
Under common law, then they own you. You got to work to pay that.
Yeah, to the extent that you can. Now understand there's one thing that's definite in life, and that's called death.
Death and taxes.
look back at the history of England. You know, when I was talking with Randy about this the other day, back in the 60s when I was in London, I went down across Tower Bridge into that part of town that's now that industrial stuff. But, man, it looked like something out of Dickens. And those people didn't have insurance. I know that, but the fact is, if people are responsible, if the risk you take when you go on the road is something might happen, lightning might strike, anything can happen. That's the consequence of life. And to assure that there's protection for you, financial protection, is bullshit because it costs you more than you ever get back out of it.
Oh, well, I certainly agree with that. Without a shadow of a doubt, it costs far more. I've never insured my house. People criticize me all the time, but I don't see the point. If anything goes wrong in the house, I can fix it myself, for one. And it's a cultural thing. It is a cultural thing, and I don't think a lot of people in this country. I think a lot of people in this country like the security that most of the drivers are insured, or actually, if according to the survey, a lot of them aren't. So, I really don't know how true it is.
Let me ask you one question. If your insurance was voluntary instead of mandatory, do you think the price would go down drastically?
If the insurance was
voluntary instead of mandatory.
I don't think half the people would even bother.
Well, it would probably get cheap enough where they would, because they wouldn't make sure that they could fix their car if there was an accident. If you had what we called comprehensive, that means I'm covered if you don't have the money to cover my car. That's what we used to have in this country.
Yeah, we have comprehensive.
Part two or something like that.
When I say fully comp, that's what it is. It's called comprehensive.
And you know, Rick, the only reason they can make you get insurance is because they own your car. It's all legal brainwashing. It's all legal crap.
Yeah, if you look at certificate of title.
There is this. We've got the. You have. I forget the name of it now. We've got what we call the DVLA, which is the driving vehicle licensing agency. And in my mind, they're a bunch of criminals. And I have thought about deregistering my car. If I deregister my car, it will cancel my insurance, which is why I won't do. I can't really do that. I'll do that. If it didn't cancel my insurance, I would do it in a heartbeat, because when we sell our car, we have to, if it's not on the road, we have to sign what's called a SORN document, which is a statutory off-road notice to the DVLA to say that the car is not on the road. Or if you sell the car, you fill out the logbooks and you send the new details on to the DVLA and it registers. Now, I've sold a van, I've sold two vans, and both of them I informed the DVLA, and I got notices back. One time I got a county court judgment. When I bought my house, I had a county court judgment against me for a SORN document that I never sent back to the DVLA. Well, I said, well, hang on, I sent you the bloody registration documents. And they reckon they sent me something preposterous, like 26 letters informing me of my court date. And I said, well, don't you think if you sent me 26 letters, I would have received at least one of them? And at that moment there, I thought, well, something's not right here. And the second time was 2 years ago, was a van I bought. And I sold the van to a friend of mine. And I sent off the log books again. And lo and behold, we've had yet another summons. And I've had another court summons. This time they're getting through. And I've replied to the letter and I said, well, I've sent you the document. And the technicality they're getting me on is, well, if I didn't receive notification of their documents, of them receiving the documents, then I'm at fault. Which I've said, well, that's ridiculous. I've given them the name. I've given them the name of the guy and the address, because I wrote it down anyway. I'm at the stage where I think, well, that's it. I'm just going to deregister my car. I don't want anything to do more to do with the DVLA. I'm going to deregister my car. But I can't do that, because that's going to cancel the insurance, and then I'm going to be
Rick,
done for something else, you know?
Rick, they want to close the program down. I'm going to say something, though, that you should recognize. The king can do no wrong. The king can do no wrong. You're in England, right? Right?
Well,
that's the government.
I've got a site.
We need to close the program now. The people are
on my show. On my show last week, we called for the Queen to be hung.
Good for you,
Darren and everybody.
But David knows for it more than us. But we did. But okay, God, I know everybody's wired, and I know everybody's
Karen, everybody, I want to thank you for the opportunity inviting us on for this 1 hour that stretched to 2 hours, and your patience with us, and I hope that we were a worthwhile addition to your marathon.
Thank you, Gary, so much. You did awesome. This was an awesome program and very informative, and I think everybody really enjoyed it. It was very engaging. Thank you so much.
It was. Otherwise, your 1 hour, you would have been out of here, Gary.
Well, thanks. I appreciate the opportunity to stay the extra hour.
Always interesting to hear you talk, Gary.
Who's that, Charles?
That's Charles, show. Yeah.
Yeah, it's Charles.
Now, I think Matt has something to say here before we close the show.
Yeah, thank you, Karen. I wanted to thank my family in Hawaii and send a special shout out to them. We lost my grandmother a couple weeks back, and they scheduled her services around our schedule to be on this broadcast today. So I'd like to thank them for their support and their ohana for allowing me to be a participant in this historic event. This is really a cool thing we've got going on, you know? So thank you, all of you. I love you all. I'll see you in a couple days. And everyone, we know what's coming, okay? Here's the countdown.
Before that comes, we would, us at United We Strike, would also like to thank Matt's family very much. For allowing Matt to participate, because if he wasn't here, the show would have been even harder than it was.
The show may not have gone on because we certainly needed you to help put the pieces together, and you were just exemplary, as was David. We have a couple of Iron Men here who can go forever and ever and ever.
David earns the title this month, because without David, guys, our show would have been dead in the water. This guy has absolutely saved us this month. And
thank you, David.
Fantastic. Thanks, David.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I'm glad that we were able to do this.
You know, we're very blessed to be this nice core group that is growing in scope to help save humanity, and I am so proud to be a part of this with all of you.
Well, the feeling is mutual, and see, Gary, you made us hang out an extra hour. We might just have to add you to the group too. Well, no turds allowed, though.
Dangle it.
All
right. And they will come.
Now, Matt, you want to count us out?
Everyone, we know what's coming. Bob Tuscan, we know you're out there in support of us spiritually. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Death. To the new world order.
Odor.
Thank you, everyone. Have a great night.
Cheers,
bye-bye,
guys.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.